Born in the pandemic era, thriving in the Zoom era, it's Resonance Rewind, sharing lessons from the creatives of yesteryear for the population of today.
Alas, my love, ye do me wrong to cast me off this courteously, and I have loved you so long, delighting in your company. Queens, this was all my joy, Queens, this was my delight. Queens, this was my heart of gold, and who but my lady Queens.
I have been ever at your hand to grant whatever you would crave. I have both wage and life and land your love and good will for to have.
Queens, this was all my joy, Queens, this was my delight. Queens, this was my heart of gold, and who but my lady Queens.
When I will pray to God on high that thou my constancy may see, and that yet once before I die thou wilt not save to love.
This was all my joy, Greens, this was my delight. Greens, this was my heart of gold, and who but my lady does.
The abandoned manor of Greensleeves is strangely restored, unknown to its rightful owner, Lord Brett Sinclair, who now needs to impersonate himself to get to the bottom of the mystery. Directed by David Green and written by Terence Feely, it's another exploration of the Persuaders for Resonance Rewind.
Thank you.
Okay, so Greensleeves is the episode of The Persuaders that we're focusing on for this edition of Resonance Rewind, directed, of course, by David Green, written by Terence Feely, and, of course, featuring Curtis and Moore and Rosemary Nichols and Charles Adams and Lieutenant Green, Cy Grant, and a whole heap of wonderful actors in this particular episode, including someone who would go on to be in Space 1999 as David Carno. Let's hopefully find out what our ITC expert and indeed quite media soul makes of this particular episode. So, Rick, over to you. Your thoughts, Mr. Rick Davey, on Greensleeves.
I love Greensleeves. It was the first Persuaders episode I ever saw. Because I don't know, maybe your older listeners might remember that back in the 80s when ITC shows were first put out on VHS video, what they would do is they would edit two episodes together and call it a film. So I bought a VHS tape saying The Persuaders London Conspiracy had Roger Moore on the front. I knew who he was. I was very young at the time, obviously. And it was the episode Greensleeves and the episode A Home of One's Own edited together to make it look like a film. So there would be no closing credits after Greensleeves. It would just jump cut to, you know, a completely different story. And I was mesmerized by it. I really enjoyed Greensleeves then, as I do still now. It is my favorite episode. It's got a mix of everything you want, not only from a Persuaders episode, but from an ITC show. So it's got a good plot where you know you wonder how they're going to get to the bottom of it. It's got some silly moments, such as Danny as the Hungarian butler. It's got some great humor in it. It's got some great guest stars. I mean, you mentioned there the lovely Rosemary Nichols, who earlier had made her name in Department S. Andrew Keir doing a typical kind of a gruff villain role. As you say, Cy Grant makes an appearance as well. Arthur Brough, no matter how old he was, always seemed to be about 90. And he's doing the same thing here in The Persuaders. It's a cracking episode, full of really lovely moments. Terence Feely, of course, was a great ITC writer, wrote episodes of The Prisoner and other series. And he's really done well with this episode. It's one of my favourites. And yeah, I can talk about it for a long time. I love The Persuaders. I love Greensleeves.
Well, Clifton Jones was the actor who played Dr. Kibu, who would go on to obviously star in Space 1999's first season. And of course, Andrew Keir, known to many and indeed Resonance Rewinders as a Quatermass from Quatermass on the Pit. So you've got a lot of what I would say screen royalty there. Plus, of course, the wonderful scenario of Roger Moore going to a theatrical agent, obviously as Brett Sinclair, and the whole aspect of Benny Ryan's incarnation, played by Tommy Godfrey, and how that was also developed and involved. Because I certainly recall when I was in London as an undergraduate and doing the rounds of agencies, etc., that was very true to life, including the keeping of the funds in the cleavage of the secretary. Perhaps that might be pushing it a bit much, but that's a different line entirely, no doubt.
Yes, absolutely. And that is a great scene. And it's a great kind of a device for Roger Moore, isn't it, to be playing somebody, playing himself, and there's some great scenes with him doing that. That's possibly a plot flaw, because you do think to yourself, if the bad guys haven't found someone who looks identical to Roger Moore, how would this plan have come about? They would have just planted someone who maybe looked a bit like him and expected his old school friend to fall for it. Probably not, but that's the fun of the episode, isn't it? Is seeing Roger Moore be too good at himself, because obviously he's found out, isn't he, at one point by Rosemary Nichols' character, to just look like him too much and to know too much about himself. But it's a great episode, lots of good humour. I love the sequences with Danny out by Cy Grant's daughter in the episode, to not be up in, is Marty Hopkirk's Minnie, or Annette Andre's Minnie from Raven Hopkirk Deceased.
Indeed, and certainly as we mentioned, obviously Cy Grant as Lieutenant Green from obviously the Captain Scarlet series, here portraying Richard Congotto. So an interesting range of things there. And obviously something which was very current at the time, and arguably then you could almost say this was the Persuaders' dig at the world of post-colonialism.
Yes, very much so. There's that undercurrent that was going on a lot at that time, wasn't there? Late 60s, early 70s in ITC shows of that kind of thing, you know, looking at, you know, the, oh, what's the word? That, you know, taking advantage of certain countries or whatever.
And exploitation. And
absolutely. That is exactly the word. Thank you so much, Alex. That's the word I was looking for. Yeah, very much that undercurrent of that. And that's again, that's what makes this episode so interesting. It's not just played for laughs. There is an undercurrent of interesting politico stuff going on there. And just, you know, an interesting plot, you know, it's a good old fashioned, you know, which way will they go thriller kind of thing as well. So there's multiple facets to this episode, which you don't get in all the Persuaders. Some of them are just played for laughs. Some of them are very dark episodes like Angie are just very kind of serious. This is a mixture of the two and probably why it's one of my favorites. But there's some great moments in it. I love the sequence where he's going through the tunnels. Taking Danny through the tunnel from the pub to the house, and he tells that, you know, that half-baked story about his cousin bricking himself in or whatever after too much to drink. That's a lovely scene.
I mean, music by Ken Thorne, of course. Many people, when they think of the Persuaders, think immediately of John Barry's theme, which clearly we feature in this episode. But again, nicely, I think, incorporated in terms of the narrative, and the director, who I wasn't familiar with, but has got quite a key track record in terms of things that he actually has done. David Green was responsible, amongst other things, for the Godspell movie, and indeed also had Rich Man, Poor Man, and the TV series Roots, where he was credited with directing that as well. So, as you said, a nice, a pleasant episode. IMDb score it pretty highly in terms of the delivery. Who would you say is your favourite character? Because it's something, as you know, Rick, we always like to quiz folk on favourite characters. Who would you say stood out for you? Or do you want to give some honourable mentions as well?
That's a very good question. I mean, you can't look past Curtis and Moore, really, if we're putting them aside as being obviously top of the pile. I did enjoy Andrew Keir's gruff, kind of menacing bad guy. I thought he played that really well. Rosemary Nichols is lovely and everything, but I think Andrew Keir was my favourite guest star. I'm glad you mentioned the music, by the way. I think the incidental music from The Persuaders doesn't get mentioned as much because of the very famous and excellent theme tune by John Barry. But you're right that the incidental music's excellent. It's such a shame that the master tapes have been lost, hence why we've never had a full kind of The Persuaders CD or vinyl release from, I mean, Network are defunct now, as you probably know, but from a company like Network. It's such a shame that we haven't got more of the music from The Persuaders to listen to, because I do think it's a guest star in itself that's worthy of mention. But Rosemary Nichols is really nice in it. And as I say, Arthur Brough telephones in his performance, doesn't he, as a typical Arthur Brough performance.
Very much so. But Andrew Keir, of course, playing Sir John Hassox. I think the name itself suggests that there are challenges within that. Whereas Rosemary Nichols plays Melanie Sadler in a role which was not too dissimilar to her role as, of course, the female part of the trio in Department S. I think there was a number of sort of key areas that crossed over with respect to that, although Rosemary never quite managed to have the same sort of longevity that obviously our wonderful regular contributor Annette Andre managed with her career.
No, and I think that might be because she was... I don't wish to be unkind to Rosemary because she's very, very likable. I think she's slightly more sort of one-dimensional than someone like Annette, who can play so many different types of roles. I think Rosemary, as you say, plays one type of character. And I guess there's only so far you can go with that.
Tom Adams, of course, known as a regular, reliable guest star, had his own attempt at being a kind of James Bond in the movie Where the Bullets Fly and various other areas, where I think he actually played the character of Charles Adams, if memory serves, or a line from that. He plays Piers Emerson in this. And again, sadly passed away this century, but worth noting in terms of the way in which he comes across as very much the villainous part of the duo with Andrew Keir in terms of, oh, well, I suppose you're going to say a trio, because you obviously have the traitor from within president's camp as well, who's effectively set everything up. So, I mean, lots of interesting lines there in terms of the conspiracy theory and overlaid elements that come across.
Yeah, absolutely. I think all the guest cast, if that's the right term, are really well cast. They all fit their characters perfectly, don't they? Even I forget the actor's name, but the chap who plays the landlord of the local pub does a really nice sort of great turn as kind of the yokel, you know. So I think everyone's really well cast in it. It's probably why the episode works so well. No one seems to be out of place. As you say, the chap playing Kibu, the villain of the piece. He does a really nice evil turn in it, doesn't he?
Indeed. So Charles Vine, of course, just correcting the line, it was not Charles Adams, Charles Vine, who was, and again, a series, sadly, I don't think Network ever managed to actually release the movie version of Where the Bullets Fly, but I will remember watching it late on a Friday night and thinking, this is very James Bond-like, and indeed it was, in a British sense of the manner. Again, just alluding to the other side of things that we have there, Clifton Jones's character as Dr. Kibu, as you say, villainous personified. We also, of course, presumably, I mean, you may know this, I'm not sure, Tony Curtis, very known for his swashbuckling roles, and he really gets the ideal opportunity to channel his inner Errol Flynn in this particular episode in more ways than one.
Oh, he does, absolutely. Yes, I'd forgotten that. It's a very well choreographed fight scene. As you say, it involves plenty of swordplay, fencing, and as well as general just sort of jumping around. But he does seem to be doing most of that himself. I'd have to look at the shots to examine when the stunt people come in. I know Roger will have done very little of his own stunts. I remember he was interviewed once, and I can't remember who was interviewing. It might have been Parkinson. And he turned around and said, Roger, do you do all your own stunts? And Roger turned around and said, well, of course I do. And I also do all my own lying.
Indeed. And interesting, because next week, of course, on Residence Rewind, we'll be looking at Live and Let Die. This, of course, the Persuaders episode, probably the period in between the Saint and Moore becoming Bond, that effectively he allows himself to, shall we say, quite literally let his hair down and become much more relaxed. That would change dramatically, of course, when we see his incarnation as Bond. And again, we'll go on to talk more about that, because he very much sort of went through a stark regimen to actually trim down and focus very much on a much more lean approach to Bond, which really stayed in place, arguably, until his fifth Bond movie, Octopussy, and View to a Kill, obviously, when he kind of eased away from that. Actually, his fifth movie was For Your Eyes Only, probably after that. Octopussy was, I think, when people started seeing Roger Moore very much as a tongue-in-cheek James Bond, as opposed to a serious blunt instrument killer employed by Her Majesty's government.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a whole show of its own, isn't there, talking about how long should an actor go on for when they're playing Bond. I mean, I do like Octopussy a lot. I've got a big soft spot for that film, but I think, and I'll never say anything bad about Roger Moore.
Indeed, although there is a moment
where... The writing
was
on the wall there, that he's been in the role too long, as you say.
I can't imagine Daniel Craig ever actually managing to pull off the line with a Bengal tiger saying, sit! Which was great if you actually could appreciate the importance of the dog trainer at the time, who sadly, again, is no longer with us, who would actually use that as her catchphrase, sit. But I don't think that would actually necessarily work. But still, that's for another time. Let's move back to the Persuaders and Greensleeves. We also mention, of course, the chance that as the faux butler, Danny Wilds / Tony Curtis also, I think, channels his inner Bela Lugosi to a certain extent, even though he's no more Budapest or Hungarian than, of course, the president's daughter.
But as you say, you quickly found out, and that was part of the plot, wasn't it? The whole point was that he didn't really know how to be a particularly good butler, and as the daughter said, you're no more Hungarian than I am.
But what a fantastic
a
red mini!
Absolutely, as I say, rather than Hotkirk's mini. So it was great that turned up in another show.
Okay, it's time now, as we've managed to go through this preceding thing, before we find out what the rest of the team actually make of this particular episode of The Persuaders, Greensleeves. What is your score, Rick Davey, for this fourth episode in the first season And which could have gone on, obviously, even longer had it not, as we've said in the past, been for a series called Mission Impossible, which effectively was greenlit, no pun intended, to actually go for a fourth or fifth season rather than actually going to a second season of The Persuaders. I think Lou Grade was counting on a second season, but it never quite manifests.
I am going to give it 9.5 out of 10. It's not getting a 10. I'm not sure what could get a 10, but it's as good as an ITC 50 minutes as there is that exists. So 9.5 out of 10 for me. I advise everybody, if they're going to watch The Persuaders and haven't watched it before, watch this episode and you'll want to watch more.
Courteously, and I have loved you oh so long, delighting in your company. Green sleeves was all my joy, green sleeves was my delight, green sleeves was my heart of gold. My lady Greensleeves, if you intend to be this way, it does the more enrapture me. And even so, I still remain a lover in captivity. Green sleeves was my delight. Green
Actors are like politicians. We say what we're paid to say. That was back in the 1970s when that line was put together by Terence Feely. And I did think it was particularly apt, having listened to, obviously, Olivia Newton-John singing Greensleeves just a few moments ago, that we actually have an episode that was indeed directed by David Green, which makes a lot of perfect sense in all sorts of ways. But Victoria Simmons, in France currently, singer-songwriter, had you ever encountered Danny Wilde and Brett Sinclair, as played by Tony Curtis and Roger Moore, ever before?
No. Nope, I've never heard of it. And I really want to watch the whole lot and binge watch it.
Well, there are 24 episodes, but I think you need to savour the development, as indeed Rick Davies said earlier.
No, I binge watched Peaky Blinders and all sorts of things, especially on Netflix, where you just keep them going. And I could binge watch this.
Genuinely a 21st century gal. Okay, we'll talk a little bit more in detail about your thoughts. What about, would you like to share with us your initial thoughts before we bring on board our very own Danny Wilde from indeed Los Angeles to share his thoughts on this particular edition?
I was surprised at the amount of amazing names that were involved. Obviously I recognised Roger Moore, and then I would say, I know this other person. Who is this? The face is slightly familiar, but the voice is just down to it. And then I looked it up and went, ah, oh, some like it hot. I know this person now. And for those two reasons, I thought this is going to be good. And then I saw some other names and I knew if these people were all involved, unless it was a downfall for every single person, then it was going to be good. You never know. Sometimes this happens.
Well, that's true. Of course.
But it just kept going with so many little intrigues and I just had fun watching it.
Fun very much at the heart of this ITC series. Fun could be said to be Chloe Rose's middle name. Chloe, I presume you've just watched The Persuaders and Greensleeves. Again, another
yes.
singer-songwriter. What are your thoughts on this particular offering for Resonance Rewind?
I really liked it. I feel like it sort of had a bit of a comedy aspect to it. I thought Roger Moore was really fun in it. I just like the idea that he was sort of impersonating his self in the manner that he'd not been back with from his family, you know, from years, like a heritage that he'd not been back to for like 3 or 4 years. And all of a sudden it's like somebody's like, you know, redone the place up and it's all a bit like, why are they there? So he has to investigate. It's really good. I really like it.
As ever, we talked with Rick Davey about Moorhead and some of the character actors who are actually in there. Cy Grant, of course, much known as being the voice of Lieutenant Green in the Gerry Anderson series. Captain Scarlet also taking the line as Richard Congotto. And of course, you have politicians who are corrupt and financiers who are corrupt from the West also again engaging in shenanigans with, of course, Rosemary Nichols playing the turncoat. Who effectively falls in the end for the charms of the good guys. And if only she hadn't worn one of those chiffon dresses, they wouldn't have realised that they'd gone into the tunnels in the first place. Must be a moral there. Let's turn to Phil Leonis, again, a gentleman who has in many ways been the Danny Wilde to my Brett Sinclair in times past. I think you cited that originally, Phil, when you weren't actually looking to push me forward as some kind of Lincolnshire actor called Jim Broadbent, which I still refute to this day. But Phil, your thoughts, please.
Well, my first thought is to question whether or not in this bizarre transatlantic relationship that we have formed, if somehow you are not the English Danny Wilde and I am somehow not the American Brett Sinclair. If there is not, I mean, after all, look who is over your shoulder right now. That's great radio, me pointing out an image. Alex, I want to start with actually that quote that you said about actors and politicians are the same. They just, you know, speak the lines that they're given. It's so funny to hear that at a time when you know, we hear all the time, you know, actors and entertainers should just stay out of politics. It was said about a famous basketball player here, shut up and dribble. People get so upset about is artists and entertainers and actors getting political. And yet it's so funny because it's the same country that had a reality star becoming a president. And one of our most beloved presidents was an actor and a president of the Screen Actors Guild. And after all, Hollywood itself has been described on more than one occasion as simply Washington, D.C., for pretty people, or more to the point, Washington, D.C. is Hollywood for ugly people. Anyway, so I loved that. I loved that little bit of historic irony reading so resonantly in this day and age. But I would echo what was already said about how much fun Roger Moore is in this, in kind of an unusual way. You know, I'm a fan of Roger Moore. Who isn't? I have two eyes and a heart. How could I not love Roger Moore? But he's particularly enjoyable in this, and such a better actor when he's pretending not to be himself, pretending to be someone, pretending to be him. There's some meta work right there. And he's at his best, most relaxed, most engaging in that. And I was struck remembering, well, that's the best part of Cannonball Run, which would be a big hit at the global box office 10 years later, where Roger Moore plays someone pretending to be Roger Moore throughout the whole movie. So there was real comedy gold that he was able to mine. And I know we won't get the chance to ask him ever again, but I wonder what was so refreshing about getting to, I don't know, kind of poke fun at himself, that it led to such a relaxed performance.
Can I ask, was this before or after James Bond?
Before.
This is one of the reasons he chooses James Bond. Despite wonderful rapport on screen between these two actors, Roger Moore did not like working with Tony Curtis at all. When the time came to say, hey, this was a decent-sized hit in the UK. No one in America watched it. But in the rest of the world, what a mammoth hit this was, winning best television show in many different countries. When the time came to pitch, let's do another set of episodes, he quite famously said, not with Tony Curtis, no. And took the offer for James Bond instead. They did not get on well, as reported by so many of the directors and everything. The irony being that Tony Curtis was very fond of Roger Moore, and I'm sure Roger Moore smoothed things over at every opportunity with his diplomacy and his sense of humor. And I think the two men did share a sense of humor. But it is interesting how, if he had any misgivings about following Sean Connery as James Bond, they were wiped away by the greater misgivings of going back to work with Tony Curtis.
And I'd also heard, as we noted with Rick Davey, that the other reason the series wasn't picked up in the States, apart from ratings, was because it was being challenged by a certain show called Mission Impossible, which had actually decided to go for a fourth season at the time. Okay, let's talk theatricals, because as I shared with Rick, I have actually met in my time in the 80s in London theatrical agents who effectively could have been taken directly from the Benny Ryan School of Theatricals, with Tommy Godfrey in the line of the lead role there. Arthur Brough, of course, as Moorhead, the butler, who referred to the rest of the staff having been healed his own way. Again, for me, those are the characters that really are believable. They're eccentric. They really actually work through the narrative, and including, as I say, the landlord of the pub that we see Curtis and Moore, Wilde and Sinclair effectively finding their secret passageway in. Even that tends to work from the basis of, as you're walking down the stairs, the fourth step, it's not there. And of course, the pratfall that we don't see, but we hear off camera that Danny Wilde actually falls into. Lots of those little mini vignettes, I think, work well. As a director, Phil, is that something that when you're putting things together, those smaller characters, but essential characters, a bit like Victoria's supporting artist in a movie that's going to be released in Blackpool later on in this year. Is that what it's all about?
I have thought about this for many years. What do we mean when we say supporting players? Going back to the theater, what do we mean by it? What are they supporting? And I think in the minds of many stars, they think, well, you're supporting me. But in reality, what supporting players are supporting is the audience's belief in the world we're seeing. We will follow a story if the leads are charming, attractive, funny, engaging in some way. If we're being entertained, we will follow the leads through a story. But to believe the world that they are going through, walking through, traveling through, we need to believe the people inhabiting that world. So I think you're absolutely right. In this episode, the success of it in no small part is based on the fact that we get key people that we believe inhabiting those occupations and those parts of the world. In fact, in the case of the pub owner, I believe it so much that I have a sneaking suspicion they actually filmed in a real pub. That set feels markedly different than, for example, the interiors of the house, the of course, the below ground passages. And not only does it feel different to me as a director, but the way they shoot it is noticeably different. They come into that pub. Roger Moore sets himself up behind, you know, on one side of the bar. And we never see Roger Moore's face again, except when he turns around to look at Danny Wilde. We don't do what is called a reverse shot, which makes me think that's because that's a real bar and they can't move that. They can't set up the equipment behind it to show Roger Moore. And it's actually, again, a wonderful example of a generous, in this case, leading man, because he clearly has no problem with, okay, we're going to play this scene entirely on the supporting actor. And your best, your greatest leads have always understood that the more we believe the supporting players, the more we believe the world, and the more the lead's role is going to be elevated, because we're going to care more about how they're affected.
At times like these, I always remember my old school motto, concilio et prudentio, sneaky is best, something which is echoed twice over and could be seen as part of the whole magical nature of acting in general. Chloe, what scenes struck your particular chord? I mean, this is a line I think Victoria suggested we should have a favourite moment as opposed to favourite actor piece here.
Oh, I feel like there's so many good moments in that episode. I kind of found it funny when he was locked in and he couldn't get out and he was like trying to find a way to, and then he found the secret door. I found that bit quite funny, and I kind of liked the bit with, I can't remember what the lady's name was, but I thought there was that flirtation between them both. I was thinking, oh, is it going to be a love story, you know?
Melanie Sadler, of course.
Yes, yeah. I liked all of it, really. I can't pick anything specifically. Mm-hmm. They're the moments, I would say, but all of it was just fun. I enjoyed it. I thought it was great acting, and I love Roger Moore. He's James Bond, so I can't go wrong with that.
Well, of course, this is something we'll be going on to look at the next Residence Rewind, but a lovely little line about how he thought the diet, for suddenly discovering the ideal diet to squeeze through the little crack when he's being pulled by Danny Wiles to escape the villain. He suddenly actually launched that because he would actually go through a fairly rigorous and robust regime to actually take up the mantle of Bond shortly afterwards, because the first Bond, of course, that Moore starred in, Live and Let Die, would be merging 72, 73 from that point of view. Rosemary Nichols, of course, was also known for her role in Department S, again, a contemporary of Annette Andre, our friend of the show from that point of view. Victoria, what about your favourite moment?
Somehow I seem to have a thing for eyes at the moment. And I have two. Well, first one, it's very much the start of it where they're peeking over the wall. Because I had, not having seen one before, I wasn't entirely sure what this was going to be about. And then suddenly you have these two guys just peeking over the wall and you're like, oh, straight away you've got that suspense. What's happening? Why are they peeking over the wall? And then also at the butler, when he suddenly sees Roger Moore and his eyes just completely widen. So I think
Moorhead.
Those two.
Moorhead, who's known Lord Brett Sinclair since he was a child. And Arthur Brough, of course, who effectively paves the way for, as Rick Davey pointed out, a cameo appearance by the same red Mini that was used in Randall and Hopkirk Deceased, this time driven by Danny Wilde, as opposed to his normal red Lotus Ferrari car, or his Ferrari car, I should say. Phil, your favourite moment? Or moments?
I have a few, and they all sort of relate to the chemistry between the actors, because I talked about how Roger Moore certainly did not enjoy working with Tony Curtis. And by all accounts, Tony Curtis was a very grumpy, angry guy at that point.
I think he just was upset because he couldn't find any cocaine when he arrived in the country. But they settled the matter. Afterwards.
You joke maybe, and yet apparently he was using marijuana. Like, he was smoking marijuana openly all the time. It was getting them into a lot of trouble on location. But that said, you know, sometimes chemistry between performers is helped by that kind of personal conflict, because we want to see tension. This is why so often actors and actresses that hate each other are so believable in romantic pairings on screen, because we see the tension and that interests us. And the comedic tension and partnership between them, I'm going to pick two moments because they're totally different. One is them running along the hedges when they first break onto the compound. I am watching on my laptop, and I can't tell you how rare this is. I laughed out loud watching them running together. Their physical chemistry with each other was delightful. And then their verbal jousting, the way these two old pros that they are at that point in time as performers, these elegant old entertainers, will give so little to some of the dialogue exchanges. There's one moment in particular where they see a photo of a young Roger Moore wearing a kilt, and Tony Curtis comments on his legs, and Roger Moore says, those aren't my legs, I borrowed them from, and Tony Curtis says, I didn't think so, as if he had been checking out Roger Moore's legs and knew that those were not. And it's just a throwaway little bit, but again, the rapport between these actors is just so funny. And this is, you know, especially back in these decades of television, right? These are the moments that kept us coming back. It was the moments that we remembered, because we weren't in the era of binge watching because we needed to know what would happen next week in the plot. These were self-contained stories. And so what we remembered so fondly were moments, and I think often, you know, human moments of vulnerability or humor.
Okay, let's move from moments then to characters. Victoria, do you have a favorite character or characters that you'd like to draw attention to from this particular experience?
A favorite. I was trying to think about this actually whilst we were talking about other things, thinking, which one's my favorite?
We haven't spoken about Carmen Monroe as Carmen Congoto, of course, the daughter of the African leader played, as mentioned by Cy Grant, Richard Congoto, and the way in which she effectively pierces the mendacity of Tony Curtis's attempt to be a Budapest-oriented individual from that point of view. And obviously Gregor, channeling, as I said, his inner Bela Lugosi, is clearly completely blown away by Carmen Congoto. Or indeed the somewhat villainous Dr. Kibu, played by Clifton Jones, who effectively had set up the deal unbeknownst to his president, but obviously was looking to go in for high mineral deposits, in the same way as even today African nations are being exploited just so we can actually have mobile phones.
No, I think I'm just going to have to go for our two leads with Roger Moore and Tony Curtis, because that, I don't know, there's something about that that bond between them. Like Phil was saying, there's just something about it that, whether they were friends or not, that creates such a strong storyline. And I think that pairing is just really good.
You mentioned Some Like It Hot, of course. I mean, the movie which you have put forward and will be indeed be considered as part of our spin-off, Residence Rewind Musicals, in the near future. Not as soon as Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, but there we are. But in terms of that, did you feel that, again, that kind of chemistry that you had there, obviously with Curtis Monroe and company, was that echoed perhaps in this? And that kind of classic line, which goes back arguably to the road to wherever movies of Bing Crosby and Bob Hope.
Yeah, there was a moment actually with the gun. And I don't know if people have seen Some Like It Hot, but of course they have, there's a whole scene with guns in Some Like It Hot. I think they're really, I don't know what the name is, they're really big, well, they're huge guns. I don't know Phil by now. And I thought his attitude to that gun was almost the same as it was in Some Like It Hot, going, oh, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do. And I just thought of comparing the two and sort of going, oh, I know how you felt in the other one. So
Curtis and Moore, definitely the characters from yourself. And what about yourself, Phil? Are you sticking with Danny Wilde and Brett Sinclair? Or are you going to go for Melanie Sadler, who I think portrayed a very effective tutor, who obviously decides that she needs to step away from the villainy? And we haven't even spoken about the villainy, of course, of Andrew Keir, who we considered as Quatermass earlier in the Residence Rewind run. From that point of view, Sir John Hassox, and of course Tom Adams, who himself played a kind of Bond light in Where the Bullets Fly and various other movies in the 1960s, playing Piers Emerson.
I am going to pick a particular part of Danny Wilde, and that is the part of Danny Wilde that is absolutely okay being, again, supporting, able to drop into the role of butler without any resentment and really without any stress about it. And as soon as he's found out, that's a relief. Now I can just, you know, more easily be of support. It's a wonderful opportunity for Tony Curtis. And he's so charming and delightful, just with the throwaways like welcome to our side, to when characters change their allegiances. And then, of course, his opportunity to sword fight. Tony Curtis, again, despite perhaps being on substances throughout making the whole thing, he nevertheless was game and, in fact, insistent upon doing every single one of his own stunts throughout the run of this series. And so that's him doing the sword fighting. That's him doing the jumping and the swinging. And he loved it. And of course, he was an old acrobatic performer, you know, going back to the 1950s. So this was a wonderful opportunity for him. And he really seems kind of boyishly enthusiastic during that whole second part of the show. So that's my favorite. And then the final thing I'll say is what I love about it so much, him being so willing to do whatever Brett needs, play any role Brett needs, is, unless I'm mistaken, at the beginning of this show, just a few episodes earlier, the first episode, they have to literally be forced to work together. And here, just a few episodes later, here's a Danny Wilde saying, oh, I don't care what role you need me to play. I've got your back. And it makes it again so refreshing to watch.
The special relationship, of course, yes. No appearance by Judge Fulton, who, of course, played by Lawrence Nesmith, put these two characters together, Nitro and Glycerin, and he lit the fuse, as we said in the opening episode, Overture, which really set the scene for the subsequent 23 episodes. That's the trouble with these English country house parties. Nothing ever happens. Probably one of the best lines I've sort of encountered. Could have actually ended there, but of course we had the final sequence of Roger Moore together with Rosemary Nichols, whilst they allow Danny to engage in his inner Errol Flynn and wander around in the tunnels of Greensleeves. But Chloe, what's your score out of 10 for Greensleeves.
Ooh. On one episode, I thought it was really good. I thought it was really fun. And I would like to watch more. And again, like what, you know, Victoria was saying, what Phil was saying, I'd definitely touch on the fact that because their chemistry on stage, whether maybe they don't get on personally, it was so good as a pairing. I just feel like, I don't know, I'd probably go for a 9. I'd go for a 9.
Okay.
For an old type of episode, like an old thing I've never seen before, for me, I thought it was really good. I'd say 9. Yes.
Victoria.
Yeah, I don't want to give it a 10. So I'm going to go a 9.5. And I did have to actually watch the Overture episode because I was so intrigued about how these two characters actually came together that I had to watch that episode.
And
so,
just
yeah,
as
9.5.
Just as we had Roger Moore making a brave attempt at singing Greensleeves, which is why we decided to have Olivia Newton-John and the Kingsingers singing Greensleeves, the classic Henry VIII compose number. Weave through that. Of course, in Overture, you also get the Tony Hatchison singers with the immortal classic Gotta Get Away, whilst Curtis and Moore are actually having a race to the hotel, which is, again, another line for another day. Phil, what's your score?
You know, this is an interesting case where the historic perspective reduces my score a little bit, because I'd be inclined, based on enjoyment, to say 9. And then I read enough to realize that this is generally considered, if not the second best episode of the series. And I say, oh, if this is the second best, well, it's not that great. That worries me. So I'm actually knocking it for, therefore, the overall quality of everything else that will follow. And I'm giving it an 8. Which is, which is fine.
It's pretty significant. And again, I think I'll probably go for a 9, all things considered. Having
which is
addressed...
the best.
There's one other episode near the end of the run, like episode 22, that's considered maybe better. So maybe we want to do that one. Or do we have enough time where I make a suggestion based on this episode
of
something
course.
That should be on a Resonance Rewind?
Of course.
This is considered in historic television lore as the final series of the great wave of spy dramas that especially England perfected so well, starting with Danger Man in 1960. And this episode itself evoked memories for me of perhaps one of the best Danger Man episodes, an hour-long installment called No Marks for Civility, Servility, where John Drake, Patrick McGoohan, goes undercover as a butler and in an old country house. And it's spectacular. And that might make a fun Resonance Rewind installment.
Absolutely. It will definitely be added to our list as we begin to continue the Spy-Fi theme, because in addition to the Ipcress file, which we consider in a fortnight from now, and of course the prisoner episode Free for All, which is ideal for upcoming elections, we'll also be next week looking at one of Chloe's favourites. Yes, it's Roger Moore as James Bond in his first ever outing as James Bond, in which we actually see how he copes with Dr. Kananga and a whole variety of other things, including David Hedison as Felix Leiter. David Hedison, of course, much known to Phil Leonis, sadly no longer with us, but we'll be exploring the delights of Roger Moore as James Bond in Live and Let Die.
I did not realize when Chloe said she wants to see more, that it was she wants to see more Roger Moore, as the ads would have said. Right.
More Roger Moore. I like
that was that. One of the Bond. That was one of the Bond ads. If you want more adventure, more excitement, more action, you want Roger Moore in.
I like
and
that.
Then, yeah, it's good.
And for us, keep on resonating.